give a talk, you know, please no questions, no interruptions. When I finish, I say, the teachings of the Lord Buddha can be comprised by the Four Noble Truths. He declared the Four Noble Truths, and within this we can find all of the teaching. The first of the Noble Truths, that all of us have dukkha. All beings, whatever realm they live, have dukkha. What is dukkha? Dukkha is dissatisfaction, restlessness, suffering, pain. I think anybody in this world does have this kind of discomfort, uncomfortableness, pain, suffering, and so on. He is exposed to it most of the time, most of the day. There are only a few occasions during the day where we have actually the opposite, that is called sukha, that means happiness, contentedness, peacefulness. So this is the first noble truth. It just says that all the beings, wherever they are, in whatever realm they are, they have dukkha. That includes the beings in the hell realms, and it includes the beings in the heavenly realms. Even in the heavenly realms, they do have slight dukkha. The second truth, or the second noble truth, is the origin of the dukkha. The origin or the cause of our dukkha is our attachment, is tanha. Is our attachment to life, is our attachment to be, or is also the attachment not to be. This is the cause for our dukkha. We are attached to this world, we are attached to our family, we are attached to our friends, we are attached to our material things that we have, we are attached to our positions, and so on, and so on. And that causes dukkha. Because when these things go, or when these things change, we will suffer from it. Or at least we have unpleasant feelings. So this is the cause for dukkha. The third noble truth is just a statement, and it said, there is an end of all dukkha. So, one can achieve the end of all dukkha. And the fourth of the noble truth is the path that leads to the end of all dukkha. And this is the one that we will mostly focus here in this monastery. Monks that have, or lay people who put on the robes and want to become monks, mostly out of the reason to go to the end of suffering, to go to the end of dukkha. Within this path, it's called the Eightfold Path, but better described, it's a path of sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila is morality or virtue. Samadhi is the ability to concentrate and rest the mind. And panya is wisdom. Wisdom developed by investigation. Panya is that brings us up, that relieves us from dukkha. Panya is the understanding, is not the understanding that takes place in our brains. It's not the understanding that takes place with conclusions or with reading. It's the understanding that the heart makes. So we have to train the heart. In this part, we have to train the heart to see what it does. Because if we don't see what we're doing, that's why we're always in trouble. We are not mindful. We don't have enough mindfulness to see what we are doing. Also, we think we know what we are doing, but we are not aware of what is actually happening, of what is actually going on. So the path of wisdom is the path of looking at the things at a closer look. Having a closer look at the things, what are we doing to ourselves? Where are all the troubles are coming from? But now let's start with the most important one. Before we even start the practice, we have to keep the five precepts. And the five precepts, that is included in sila, in virtue. the five precepts, the first precept is not to harm any living being, not only human beings, but any living being. Not to harm any living beings. The second precept is not to take what is not given. That, of course, includes stealing, but it's more than stealing. Not to take what is not given. So if you're not sure that it has an owner, we should not take it. The third precept, not to lie, not to use harsh and abusive speech. The fourth precept, no sexual misconduct. That means if I have a partner, then I'm faithful to this partner. In the other way, it means not using somebody or the other sex for one's own personal pleasure. This is sexual misconduct. And the fifth precept, no alcohol, no drugs that reduce our mindfulness. This is a must. The precepts, to keep the five precepts, this is a must. It's not an option if you want to go on the path. And it's also a must. If we want to stay in the realms of human beings, after our death, if we do not keep the precepts, it's like our passport is taken away to enter the human realm again. It is taken away for a while, for a short while, or for a long while. So I want you to keep that in mind. I really want you to advise that these five precepts are there for our protection. What does it protect us? It protects us from falling down in the lower realms. What are the lower realms? The lower realms start with the animal realm, then go to the ghost realms, the demon realms, and the hell realms. If you don't want to go there, we better keep the five precepts. The five precepts are mostly in all of the religions that are on this world, more or less. Except for the case in Buddhism, the fifth precept, no alcohol and no drugs. And that is there to keep our mindfulness. When we are drunk, we say things that are against the five precepts. Or we do things that are against the five precepts very easily, without even knowing it, without even noticing it. Only then, after we get sober again, we feel regret. That's why the fifth precept is there. It's your choice. It's up to you what you do. But I just let you know, if you do not keep them, you might have to suffer later. It is just like in the world. In most of the countries, when you have a driver license and you drive drunk and driving, then they take your driver license away. It can be for a short while or it can be for a long while. It depends on the heavity of the crime. And so is it with us. When we do not keep the five precepts, we are not, for a while, we are not allowed to come back to the human realm. And if you like, but if you like these lower realms, you know, then it's fine, you know, it's fine with me. Just remember this well. The Lord Buddha gave these five precepts to all the lay people as their protection. Not to drink, not to sexual misconduct, what is very common here in Thailand, but also in the West. To lie, abusive speech, to steal, or to take what is not given, and to kill animals or harm living beings. Most of the people in the world do that daily. So they have only one choice. After their death, they go down. Most of the people have only one choice. They don't even get in touch with the sasana. They don't even get in touch with the religion. They are not even interested in the religion. And they have only one way. And that is down. That is what the Lord Buddha said. That is what the Lord Buddha taught. When Venerable Ananda asked the Lord Buddha how many people are going down to hell and how many people are going up in heaven, he said, do you see that bull over there? How many hairs does he have on his fur that are standing for the people who go down to hell? How many horns does he have? These are standing for the people who go to heaven or Nibbana. So it's up to you, take your choice, if you want to be the hairs on the fur or if you want to be the horns. The Lord Buddha made it very descriptive. When we remember the Christian religion, then even Jesus said, the masses are going through the broad door that leads to destruction. It's only the few who take the stony path that leads to heaven. Remember this very well and keep the five precepts, for it's for your own sake. You don't do any good to me. I'll keep them. You do just do good for you. So this is the importance of the five precepts. This is the importance if we want to start, even want to start practice, then we have to keep it. As another prerequisite that is for most of us who really want to get serious into practice are three virtues that are not comprised in these five precepts. That is the virtue of respect, it's a virtue of generosity, and it's a virtue of gratitude. These things are necessary. These things are necessary for us to take up seriously practice. If we haven't been generous in the past, we will not find a place that is convenient for us to practice, because the people around us will not support us. If we do not have respect, then we will not listen to our teacher who tells us what to do and how to do and how to proceed. If we don't have gratitude, we do not take the teaching as something that will help us on the way. So if we do not have developed these virtues in our past lives, it will be very difficult for us to stay here in a monastery or in another monastery, in this monastery or in another monastery for a long time. We will be forced by our karma that we have made to go back. So samadhi is the one thing that in the beginning, when we come here, we practice, we concentrate on most. What does samadhi mean? Samadhi means concentration. Samadhi also means a state of rest, a place of rest. That's where the first time we can rest our citta. That means our heart. We always, every day, we rest our head upon the pillow. We fall asleep so that the next day we have energy to start working again. But when was it the last time that we rested our citta? When was it the last time where we really completely put our mind to rest? When the mind wasn't working. Because while it's sleeping, it's still working. It's dreaming. So that is the first kind of work that we have to do here. We have to get the mind, really, or shut down the mind. If you're sitting in a car, where you're still running the engine, you will not hear anything below that noise level. Only once you stop the engine, you will hear all the sounds that are around you. Now you imagine that because, you know, the engine is always running, that these sounds do not exist. Because you never heard them. Once you stop your engine, you will hear all the sounds that are around you, that have been always there. And that is the same thing with samadhi. Once we stop our mind to think, go into thinking, into memory, or into associations, or into views and opinions, once the mind stops, it will realize that there are lots of phenomena around us. Phenomena in the world, or you can call it also the realm of experience. There's just experience. Experience of the things that are around us, that have been always around us, and that will be always around us, but we are just not be able to perceive them because our mind is working constantly without giving us a rest. So this is the first task that we first have to shut down this engine. This constant engine of thinking this, thinking that, being constantly in the past or being constantly in the future. If we can't do that, we won't have a chance to get further on the way. And we won't have a chance to get satisfied and contented and peacefully and happy. Because that is the only place where happiness arises just on its own. Where peacefulness just arises on its own. When we go into samadhi, when we rest the mind, then what has to arise is peacefulness or happiness or contentedness. It depends on the character, you know, if it's more happiness or it's more peacefulness or more contentedness. But one of these things will certainly arise to a very, very big degree. And it's the first time where we actually feel safe for the first time in our life. It's like we come back into the womb of our mother where we feel safe. This is one thing. This is one byproduct of our training of samadhi, training of concentration. Once we are concentrated completely, and we take one object only that we concentrate on, once we are concentrated completely, then this concentration, as a byproduct, will lead to this peacefulness and happiness. Once our mind doesn't run around like a wild animal, and it does run around, you just have to watch it, observe it 5 minutes, and it will run around. It goes here and goes there, thinks about this, thinks about that, goes back in the past and plans a future. The past has gone, the future hasn't arisen. The only thing that we are never aware of is the present moment. We are never aware of what is happening right now here in this moment. Because all our thoughts are drawn into the future or dealing with the past. Or we're constantly worried about this or worried about that. We're worried about where we get our next food from or where we get the clothes from or what we are going to do next. So there will be never any rest. The only time when there will be rest, once we put our attention on one object. And the object of our concentration is either the tip of the nose where we realize that the breath is coming in, the breath is going out, or it is the mental repetition of the word Buddha. Buddha, 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 Buddha. Mental, not loud. We sit there with closed eyes and repeat Buddha, Buddha, Buddha until the mind shuts down. Until it completely shuts down. Samadhi has three kinds of samadhi that you can distinguish. The first is the form of kanika samadhi that is rarely. That just means you go down into deep samadhi and within a second you come back up. This is not very common, especially not for Westerners. The second type of samadhi, the most common type of samadhi, is upacara samadhi. That means, you know, when the mind stops thinking. When we feel in a safe place. When our mind gets happy and contented. Let's say when we are out in the storm with a ship, you know, and we find a haven where we can rest. This is samadhi. This is upacara samadhi or access samadhi. Access samadhi, why is it called access samadhi? Because it gives us access to all the other realms. All the other realms of beings, or it gives us access to all the phenomena that happen within this universe. That's why it's called access samadhi. It's like a big train station where you can take the trains to all these different realms. If you're able, if you know your way around in this train station, and if you know how to board a train. Then you can go to the heavenly realms, or you can go to the lower realms, wherever you want. You can go there and visit, and see for yourself that they really do exist. That's why it's called access samadhi. On the other hand, access samadhi, if you don't have the skills, it's very difficult to find your way through. That's why it's called access samadhi. Then the last and the deep kind state of samadhi, that is really the deep state of sleep. That is called Apana Samadhi or Deep Samadhi. And that is when the mind, when we enter the mind and concentrate it on one object, just one object, this Buddha. Once the Buddha disappears, or once the breath disappears from all, from our awareness, then actually what is going to happen, that the breath is going to merge with the observing of the breath. And we enter one-pointedness. One-pointedness is one point. So, when we look at our universe, it's always two points. There's an observer and there's an observed object. There are two points. There's an object and there's somebody who knows about this object. Once these two things merge, then there is just knowingness. Just knowingness. What does it mean, just knowingness? Everything has to disappear. Everything except for this knowingness has to disappear. That means in our experience when we enter Apana Samadhi, that means that at first the body will disappear from our awareness. At the next stage, this whole universe with all the senses will also disappear. And all what is left is knowingness. It is an important step in our practice if we can attain to this deep state of samadhi. It's not easy because a lot of things are happening in the upachara samadhi or in the access samadhi when we are not familiar with all these phenomena that are around us. It's difficult to find one way into one-pointedness. But once we found it, then the mind really stops. It really completely stops. You don't even know, the time stops, everything stops. You don't even know how long you have been there. The only thing that you know when you come out is that you're completely refreshed, you're completely energized, and your mind is completely shocked. And you know that you have been in a wondrous state. In an amazing state of mind. Something that you can't reach or that you can't find in this whole world or in this whole universe. Not only that you can't find this kind of state, but you even can't find upachara samadhi. The previous state, you can't buy it in this world. You can't buy it through books, or you can't buy it through going to movies or going here or going there. You can only find it within your own heart. When I talk about heart, I mean the citta. The citta, the driver of the car. There you can find it. The citta has two aspects. One is called the heart, and the other called is the mind. These are the two main aspects of the citta. Because we are familiar with the word heart, and we are familiar with the word mind, that's why I use this mind. These two words. But there, if you remember it well, citta has these two aspects. These main aspects. There's many more facets, but these are the two main aspects. So once the citta goes there into the deep state of samadhi, it will realize that everything has disappeared. All this whole universe has just collapsed. It just has disappeared. It's such an amazing state. It's just one of the wonders of practice. That we can attain to. That if one has actually attained to it, if one actually has dropped down to into this state, he will never ever ever forget it in his whole life. It is like burned into his heart, this remembrance. And this remembrance or this experience is so important that Thanacha Mahabodha calls it the Nibbana of the little man. Nibbana is the end of all of our suffering. Nibbana is the freedom. And that's what we can have a preview when we go into the state of Apana Samadhi. It's a preview of Nibbana. It doesn't mean we are actually in Nibbana, but it's a preview of it. It's just like you see a preview of something. You're not actually there, but you know how it looks like. So if you're not sure, when you start your practice and you really want to know what Nibbana is like, then you better make yourself determined and put in a lot of effort to get into this deep state of samadhi. It is possible. It might take a while. And we do this. We do samadhi by putting our mind just on one object. Just on the object of the breath at the tip of the nose. We do not follow the breath. We just put our attention at the tip of the nose and know that the breath is coming in and know that the breath is going out. And the same thing we do with the Buddha. We mentally repeat the word Buddha until the word Buddha becomes automatic. And then we know that the Buddha is still there. Then we know that the Buddha is fast, or we know that the Buddha is slow. We know that the Buddha is shallow, or we know that the Buddha is deep. We have to retract, if you understand what I say. We have to retract to the knowing faculty of the heart. Because that's where we actually want to go. But because we do not know it, in the beginning of our practice, we do not know the knowing faculty of the heart, we have to develop it. And we develop it by observing the breath at the tip of the nose, or by mentally repeating the word Buddha and then observing the word Buddha, the repetition of the word Buddha. If our mind is very restless, our repetition of the word Buddha will be very fast. If the mind gets calm, the word Buddha will become slower and slower and slower. Until it becomes very fixed and very determined, until it becomes so fixed that we even can't, our concentration becomes so fixed that we even cannot think one more Buddha. And then the next step is that we retract to the knowingness of this, that we cannot even think one more Buddha, because the mind is really focused in. And this feeling of focus and focusing in, it's just like a feeling, you know, you really swoop in. The mind really swoops in. It's a mental feeling that you will realize. Once the mind gets concentrated, it just swoops in. And then we just swoop in the right place, and that is the knowing nature of the heart. And then we are there. And however long we will stay there, that's how long we stay. When we come up, when we come out, mostly sooner than later, because we don't forget this experience. This experience is something that most of us, whoever have gone there, the next time they sit down and practice, want to go there. And then it becomes very different. They have no other interest of going there back into that state. It's such an amazing state. And it's not beyond our abilities to go there. But it takes quite a lot of effort and determination not to let the mind go off. That means, you know, once we are putting our attention, that being it in the sitting position or being it in the walking position. In the walking position, of course, we have our eyes open. In the sitting position, we do not. We keep the eyes closed. When in the walking position, when we walk up and down, we keep our eyes focused about 1 meter above, in front of us. We do not look right or we do not look left. Just to keep the the strains of the eyes at the minimum, or the senses that come through the eyes at the minimum. When we walk, we keep our Buddha, and when we sit, we keep our Buddha. And when a thought comes out and pulls us out, then we immediately go back to our Buddha. And that is where we have to put actually all our effort into. The moment we realize we are out in thought, we come back immediately and go back to our Buddha. The moment we realize we have been in the past, we go immediately back to Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. When we realize we have been in thinking, we go back to Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. or when we realize we have been into the future, we go back to Buddha. And that is where all our effort takes place. So, this is the work for most of us who come here only for a short time, just to get the ability to concentrate the mind, just the ability to calm the mind down and make the mind contented or peaceful or happy. The second stage, or the third column of the Eightfold Path, is the column of wisdom. This wisdom is going to bring us to the end of all dukkha. And the wisdom starts with the five khandhas. Five khandhas are the five groups that our personality exists of. Whatever we think we are is called or can be grouped into these five groups. This is the group of the body. This is the group of feelings. Feelings, be it pleasant feelings or unpleasant feelings or neutral feelings. It can be bodily feelings or it can be mental feelings. That's the second group. The third group is all our memories and all our associations. You know, associations is when we see a tree, actually what we see is not a tree, but we, you know, we labeled it tree. This is association. That's called association. So memories of all our life or of all the past, you know, is called memories and association. That is the third group. Sanya, or thinking, or short thoughts, views and opinion, is the fourth group. And consciousness is the fifth group. Without consciousness, we are not even aware of anything at all. So whatever we say is me, is I, is my personality, can be put down into one of these groups. When I say I'm sick, you know, that's a group of feeling. When I say my body is healthy, that's a group of body. When I think or I have this view or this opinion or this position, this is the group of thinking. When I was like this, this is a group of memory. Whatever I think I am can be put into one of these groups. So, for the sake of deliverance, for the sake of freedom. Everybody wants to be free. Nobody wants to be oppressed by somebody. And the only force that suppresses us, you can call it the darkness when you're from Christian tradition, or you can call it avijja, the magician, if you come from the Buddhist tradition. This is the one thing that keeps us in our prison. In the prison of I want and in the prison of I don't want. In the prison I like and in the prison I don't like. In the prison of heaven and in the prison of hell. Because if you have heaven, then you have to have hell. You have to have the opposites. You have to have duality. When there is good, then there is bad. You cannot have only good, because then you don't know that there is good. You have to have duality. When you have good, then you have bad. So in avijja, if you translate it directly, avijja is the power that wants to know and wants to understand, but is not able to know and not able to understand in line with the truth. Whatever we understand in the line with the world, that is the understanding of avijja. And this is the power that keeps us in our prison. So to undermine the power, we have to analyze these five khandhas, or these five groups. And the first group that we stuck on is the group of the body. Because we think we are this body. Or we think this body is us. Now just imagine, you sit in a car, or you were born in a car and you will die in the car. You still, the moment you get out of the car, you know that the car and the driver are two different things. But if you have never been out of the car, you might imagine that the car and the driver are one and the same thing. So when the car dies away, then you feel very sorry. Because you don't know that you can just step out and buy a new car. That is the same relationship with our chitta and the body. The chitta is the one that drives this body. The chitta is the one that moves this body. The chitta is the one that moves our brains. That makes thoughts happening. That is the chitta. So it's a driver. Once the chitta gets completely calm, the whole body disappears. Everything disappears. Because there is no driver. It's just like the driver in the car, you know, turns off the key and the engine will stop. And there's no running noises anymore. And then he opens the door and gets out. And then he looks at the car from outside. And then he sees, okay, the car, I'm not the car. Because I can look at it. That is the relation that we have to understand. The driver of the car is not the car. So the chitta and the body are two different things. As long as we believe that this body is us, then the moment we die, we are really in trouble. Because then we think we die. And we feel very sorry or we feel very frightened because we don't know what is going to happen after. But if we come to the understanding, and this understanding we have to work on. If we come to the understanding that the chitta and the body are two different things, really two different things. And the chitta is the driver of the body. That is the one who commands his body around. Without any command from the chitta, the body wouldn't fudge. It wouldn't move. The arms wouldn't move. The eyes wouldn't move. Nothing would. The only thing that would go on when the chitta is completely calm is the breath and the heart. This is a function of the body. The breath and the heart. As long as the body still has the breath, you can call it alive. This is not control. Not this kind of functions are not controlled by the chitta. But everything else is controlled. So we have to understand. So we have to understand the group of the body. Once we got to the understanding that the body and the chitta are two different things, once really the chitta understands, you know, that it's not the body, this is a big step. It's one of the fetters that binds us. There are 10 fetters that binds us to the realm of rebirth. The first fetter is the feather of doubt. Doubt that there's heaven, doubt that there's hell, doubt that there's karma. Karma, what means karma? Karma means cause and effect. In the Western society, we all believe in physics, so we know cause and effect. When I put a stone in motion, it will have an effect on the environment. Whatever I do will have an effect. But that also holds true for our mental actions, for our physical actions, and for our vocal actions. Our vocal actions will have effect. And that is called karma. If we are using harsh speech, or if we are getting angry against somebody, then this will have an effect that in the future, this effect will come back to us. That somebody else gets angry with us. If we do something good, then the effect will come back to us that somebody does something good to us. This is, in Christian terms, it's called what you sow that you will reap. If you sow generosity, you will reap generosity. If you sow love, you will reap love. And if you sow anger, you will reap anger. If you kill by a sword, you will be killed by a sword. That is the law of karma, or in Christianity, it's the law of what you sow that you will reap. So it's pretty much known to us. It's pretty much forgotten in the West as well, because we don't believe it anymore. We believe in physics, but we don't believe in the physics of ourselves, in our mental actions, in our physical actions, in our vocal actions. We don't think they will have a result. And that is where all our problems start. These things, whatever we say, will have an effect. It will have an effect on the other people, and this effect will come back to us like a boomerang. Just be wary of that. So do whatever, you know. In German there is a saying, What you don't want to do, others to do unto you, don't do unto others. And that comprises, when we really would do, whatever we do, whatever we say, whatever we think, would be in this law, then we wouldn't be in any troubles at all. We would be the most happiest person in this world. But because we constantly forget this law, that's why we are constantly in trouble. That is the law of karma, that is the law of cause and effect. Whatever we put into motion, be it with thinking, be it with with speech, or be it with action, this will come back to us. If it was done good, then it will come back as a good result. If it was done bad, then it will come back as a bad result. So karma, that I was talking about, the first feather that binds us, that is not believing in karma, not believing in this law of cause and effect, not believing that there is heaven and there is hell. From Christianity we are trained that there is heaven and hell. But heaven and hell are not eternal. They are just transitory states. That's all what they are. We will be there in heaven for a while, or we will be in hell for a while, but we will come back. We will change our state to another realm of being. The second fetter is just what I mentioned, the five precepts. Constantly going against the five precepts. Constantly breaking this five precepts. Taking it on and taking it off. Taking it on and taking it off. The Pali is called Silabhada Paramasa. That means constantly fiddling with the five precepts. When we keep them, then we keep them, and we keep them for the rest of our life. So, that means when we go against the fetter of doubt, that means heaven and hell, and then the law of karma, when we eliminated this one, when we eliminated the fetter that we constantly preach the five precepts, or go against the five precepts, and then we finally got to the conclusion, or we've got to the insight, that the citta and the body are two different things, then it's for us the time to enter the stream. Entering the stream that leads to Nibbana. It's the first noble person. The Lord Buddha called it a noble person, the one who enters the stream. Entering the stream means that no matter what, he will end up in Nibbana. It will take at most 7 more lives to finish his work, but he will end in Nibbana. The Sotapanna then, and that's what it's called, stream entry in Pali, has still to finish the next two fetters, cross fetters of greed and hate. So he has to work against greed and hate. And greed and hate are still rooted in the body. So, the work of the Sotapanna, the work of the Sakadagami, that means a once returner, who has just cut down half of the greed and half of the hate, is working on greed and hate. That is, means he is still working in the confinement of the body. He is still analyzing the body until he truly understands the true nature of the body, the true nature of the loathsomeness of this body. Until that stage, until he finally realizes the true nature of this body, then he can advance to the state of anagami. An anagami is a noble person. It's a third kind of noble person. He will never ever come back into the realms of existence, in the realms of beings. And at most, it will take him 50,000 more years to end up in Nibbana. There are, above the heavenly realms, there are 5 realms that are just reserved for the anagamis to fulfill their aim. An anagami doesn't come back into the heavenly realms, he doesn't come back into the human realm, he doesn't come back into the lower realms. And the same thing for the Sotapanna. For the Sotapanna, he will not come back anymore, he will not be reborn anymore in the lower realms. That is a guarantee. Whatever he does, and he, you can be sure that he's not doing anything against the five precepts. He's the first person who keeps the five precepts perfectly. So he will not, never ever go down again. And the last stage is the group of investigation, is the investigation of the four mental khandhas, or the four mental groups. That's what I described with the groups of feeling, mental feeling, the groups of memory association, the group of thinking, and the group of consciousness. Once he has understood these four mental groups, then he will be relieved, and he will be an arahant, who will never be, ever be redone, somebody who has finished his work, somebody who has gained enlightenment, somebody who is free, though he still has his five khandhas to go. He has still his body to live, he has still the memories of his past, and he will still have his thoughts. Nothing of this will change. The only thing that will change is that his citta is liberated, is free from all these things. And when he dies, he will go into Nibbana. When he is still in the world, whenever he concentrates, he will be in Nibbana. That is the place where he normally rests. His body will still be in this universe or in this conventional reality. His thoughts will still be in conventional reality. All the five groups are groups of conventional reality. They have nothing to do with a state of liberation of the citta. But he understands them completely because he has investigated them completely. And this kind of investigation is called the development of wisdom. And wisdom is the one thing that will lead us to the end of dukkha. But don't mix it up. The Eightfold Path, or the path that leads to the end of dukkha, is comprised of three columns. We cannot leave sila out. We cannot leave the five precepts out. We cannot skip the option of concentrating. We cannot skip samadhi. At least the lowest state before we actually can do our work for investigation is to reach upachara samadhi. We have to reach upachara samadhi to get the mind rested, to get beyond thoughts, to see or to experience the realm of the phenomena, then all these three things will work together. So, that's why it's called the Eightfold Path, or that's why it's comprised in these three columns. These three columns, all of them need to be developed to the fullest before we can enter to the state of Rahant. So, that was, in short, the teachings of the Lord Buddha. Take it to heart, take what you want. It's your responsibility to take up the practice. You have to do it for yourself. You are responsible only for yourself. I'm not responsible for you. It's not, you don't do these things for me. You do not practice for myself. You do not do me a favor if you practice, or you do not do me a disfavor if you do not practice. It's for your own sake. It's for your own wealth. It's for your own happiness. It's for your own contentedness that you're going to start this work. So, and with this, I'll end the talk. Now, if you have any questions, you are welcome to ask them.